can be seated. We're going to be in 2 Samuel chapter 1 this morning, continuing our study of the life of David. And next Sunday will probably, most likely, be the last Sunday for this sermon series, at least for a while. We're going to get to the point where David is anointed king of Judah, and then we're going to stop there and move on, do something else for the remainder of the year. We're getting into the holiday season, other things coming up, so we'll pick up this David series at some point in 2023, but next week will be the concluding one for this series anyway. So I'm going to read 2 Samuel, as soon as I turn some light on, so I can see. I'm going to read 2 Samuel chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, and then we'll talk about it. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp, with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How'd it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." So this is this man's account of what happened in that battle. The writer's account of what happened is in 1 Samuel 31. And David, he knew about the fighting, right? He was at that Philistine war camp in Aphek before the fighting started. Remember, we talked about that last week. He was there with his men, with Achish and the other Philistine kings, came through the camp and saw him there and were like, he is not going into battle with us. Send him home. And that's when David and his men found that Ziklag, the city that Achish gave them to live in, had been burned. And all their family members had been taken. They'd been kidnapped. So they tracked them all down with the help of an Egyptian slave who belonged to one of those Amalekite raiders. And since then, I'm sure David had been wondering how the war campaign was going, especially now that he has turned his heart back to his God. He hadn't been back home to Ziklag long when this guy shows up, and this fellow's clothes are torn. The writer tells us he has dirt on his head. Now, it could be that Buddy's just had a really rough day. He is coming from a battlefield. But that also sounds a lot like an outward sign of mourning for the dead. Not sure which one that is, but David's eager to find out. We can almost feel David's urgency in verse 4. He's like, "What happened? What happened? Tell me what happened. I need to know." And the guy makes it sound really bad. Because it was really bad. But when he gets to the part about Saul and Jonathan, it's almost like David interrupts him. He's like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa. What did you just say?" Because verse 5 says he asked the young man, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" You see, David is a decorated combat veteran. And he knows that in these large-scale battles like the one this guy was at, people like him aren't usually anywhere near kings and princes like Saul and Jonathan. You only find the bravest and most trusted soldiers fighting with them. And apparently this guy doesn't strike David as that. Plus, David knows the men who Saul trusts and who Saul leans on, and this guy ain't one of them. So David wants to know, "How do you know that Saul and Jonathan are dead?" And y'all, the more this guy talks, the more he sounds like he's full of caca. Let's look at verses 6 through 10. "And the young man who told him said, 'By chance.'" Okay, "by chance. Just so happens I was there. I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear. And behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close up upon him." You got to love all those dramatic details, right? He's really selling the story. "And when he looked behind him, he saw me. And he called to me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.'" Now, we talked about the Amalekites last week. They just keep showing up, keep popping up at the worst possible times if you're an Israelite. Verse 9, and he said to me, stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers. Verse 10, so I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And here's the best part, okay? And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my Lord. So the doo-doo's about right here at this point. You know, I mean, David can taste it in his mouth. Here's what really happened, okay? This is 1 Samuel 31. This is verses 1 through 8. This is the writer of Samuel. Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain at Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. The battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me. But his armor bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and all his men on the same day together. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled. And the Philistines came and lived in them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. So, four times in that brief passage, the writer tells us that Saul was dead and he died by his own hand. Right? His armor bearer and even saw that he was dead in verse 5. So, this lying little Amalekite, if he was on Mount Gilboa, most likely it was in verse 8, stripping the dead of anything valuable, like a crown or a royal bracelet. I mean, what better way to endear yourself to the future king than by handing him the former king's royal property and by telling him, hey, that man that's been trying to kill you for years, he's dead now. You don't have to hide here in Ziklag anymore. But you know, David is not just a future king. If being king is what drove David, he'd have been king by now. He had Saul dead to rights a couple times and he let him go. And toward the end of Saul's life, y'all, he really got sloppy. He let his guard down. If David and his guys had decided to go after him, they'd have got him. They'd have got him. You know, I'm totally speculating here, okay? So this is me talking, not the Bible. But the more I learn about David, the more it seems to me that he doesn't want to be king. Like Jonah was a reluctant prophet, I think David's a reluctant king. If you let him choose, I think he would gladly go home to his dad's farm in Bethlehem and resume that quiet life that he had in the hills. I really think that's what he was trying to do going to Achish and Gath. It's why he asked for a quiet place away from other people for him and his companions to live quietly without conflict. Because David's a shepherd, y'all. He likes to hunt and play guitar, you know. His political aspirations are zero at this point in his life. He didn't ask for any of this. So have any of y'all ever felt like God wanted you to do something? Or maybe he wanted you to start moving in a particular direction, but you really did not want to do that. You did not want to because you knew it was going to shake your life up if you did. Or it's going to make you give up a well-paying job for a lesser-paying job. Or maybe move you away from people that you've known your whole life, people you were comfortable around. Maybe, like David, God was wanting you to do something that is totally out of your comfort zone. And you played along for a while, But you got to a point where you're like, this is too much. This is just too hard. I don't understand this. This is all crazy to me. I don't want to do this. So you decide in your heart to go to Gath. I think that's what David did. Y'all, this is the dangerous part about following Jesus. If you're committed to Him, He's going to ask you to do some uncomfortable things. Hard things. Things that you may think aren't even necessary. It's like, why are we doing it this way, Jesus? We don't have to do that. We can do it this way. It's a lot easier. It's a lot simpler. And if this happens often enough, we start to reason with ourselves that maybe we got enough Jesus. You know? Maybe we got enough. Because I go to church a couple times a month. That's pretty good. I don't drink much. We had our kids in Sunday school when they were little. Now that they're grown, they don't want anything to do with the church, but they know who Jesus is. They know who Jesus is. I even vote straight Republican down the ticket. So I think I'm okay. I think I have enough Jesus. I asked Jesus into my heart. I am saved. But this life He wants for me, I don't want to do this anymore. It's too hard. It's too restricting. And as time goes by, it gets easier to do that. It gets less awkward that you're not trying to get closer to Jesus. At first, you're like, man, I really should read my Bible more. Or you wake up one morning and you're like, when was the last time I actually talked to Jesus? It's been at least a week or so. Those nudges are important, but eventually those nudges are going to stop. And we can even convince ourselves that the reason they stopped is because God's okay with us where we are. We're like, I'm good. This is okay. God's okay with this. And what we don't understand at that point is that the nudges have not stopped. We just don't feel the nudges anymore. I think that's what David is doing. I think that's what got David to this point. He stopped feeling. That's why feelings aren't trustworthy. Okay? Because the mind usually follows the heart, right? And if I've decided in my heart that I want to go to Gath, well, my mind is going to invent all kinds of justifications for doing that. And when your time in Gath stretches into years, like David's did, for God to get you back, He's going to have to break you, which is what He did to David. And y'all, we don't know what that threshold is. We do know that some of His wayward children will start to feel those nudges again, and they will work their way back to their church and to their family and to their God. But that wasn't David. That wasn't this man after God's own heart. So for us to try to push the boundaries or skim as close as we can get to them, thinking that our past obedience is enough to keep God from being heavy-handed with us, that is a very dangerous game we're playing. Extremely dangerous. Psalm 94 talks about God's preventative discipline, where God gets heavy with us just to keep us from moving further into a more dangerous disobedience. The writer of Psalm 94 says this in verses 12 through 15. It says, "Blessed is the man whom You discipline, O Lord, and whom You teach out of Your law, to give him rest from days of trouble until a pit is dug for the wicked. For the Lord will not forsake His people. He will not abandon His heritage. For justice will return to the righteous, and all the upright in heart will follow it." Psalm 38 is a song that is filled with pain and guilt. It is very dark. Here are verses 1 through 4 of Psalm 38. It says, "O Lord, rebuke me not in Your anger, nor discipline me in Your wrath. For Your arrows have sunk into me, and your hand has come down on me. There is no soundness in my flesh because of your indignation. There is no health in my bones because of my sin. For my iniquities have gone over my head like a heavy burden. They are too heavy for me. Y'all know who wrote that? David. God's harsh discipline is something that David would become very familiar with over his life. And in that song, I mean, David admits that he's wrong. He admits that God is totally just in the way that he's handling him. But y'all, that hurts. That kind of discipline hurts. It's supposed to hurt. It's a hurt that's supposed to help. God's discipline is there for our development. That's what Proverbs 3 tells us, where it says, "My son, do not despise the Lord's discipline or be weary of his reproof. For the Lord reproves him whom he loves as a father the son in whom he delights." It's real easy for us to forget that. The writer of Hebrews quotes those verses in chapter 12 just in case his readers need to be reminded that that is still the case. Whether you're an Iron Age warrior poet like David or a first century Jesus follower, God is the same. He does not change. He has not changed. I tell you what we do not want, and that is for God to ignore us when we fail Him, because that's how He handled Saul. There's a really weird story in 1 Samuel 28 about Saul going to visit a psychic or a medium or a necromancer, whatever you want to call him. She was someone who claimed she could talk to the dead. Not the kind of folks God wanted His people spending time with. The law of Moses was full of warnings about these dead talkers. But the reason Saul goes to her is because he felt God was ignoring him. He felt like God was avoiding him. This is verses 5 through 7 of chapter 28. It says, "When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams, or by Urim, or by prophets. Then Saul said to his servants, 'Seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her.' And his servant said to him, 'Behold, there's a medium at Endor.'" And Saul's like, "Groovy, let's go. Let's go see her." It wasn't long after that, maybe just a day or two, that Saul and his sons are killed by the Philistines. So we might wonder why God goes after David to restore him, but he ignores Saul and he lets Saul fall off a cliff. And I think that's a fair question. I think God's okay with us asking questions. He can handle questions. And I don't know the answer to that question. I can tell y'all what I think the answer might be, and I think it's David's heart. I don't think it's what these two men did, like somehow David's sins weren't as awful as Saul's sins were, because David did some horrible things. But when you look at David's intentions, they're not what Saul's were. Okay? Saul's favorite thing in the world was Saul. Okay? He seemed to make decisions based on how they would impact him personally. A lot of times he acts more like a paranoid drug cartel leader than God's anointed king. Like in 1 Samuel 13, when Saul's at Gilgal, he's waiting for Samuel. He's got a fight with the Philistines coming up, and Samuel's supposed to offer burnt offering to God to seek his favor in battle. Well, Saul gets tired of waiting. So he steps outside his role as king and he offers sacrifice. That is something that only priests are allowed to do. And when Samuel shows up, he looks at Saul and says, "What did you do?" And Saul tells Samuel, basically, "Well, this is your fault. You should have been here when you said you were going to be here." That's what Saul did. Like last week, we talked about 1 Samuel 15, where God told Saul to wipe out the Amalekites. Wipe them out. But Saul decides, "I'm not going to do that. I can use these people. Plus, they've got all this good livestock and cattle. It'd be a waste to just kill everything. Right? Plus, Saul spent years hunting David, trying to kill David, even though David never harmed him in any way. Y'all, Saul even tried to kill his own son once. Remember that? He hurled a spear at Jonathan, accused Jonathan of disloyalty. He even talks like a cartel kingpin, doesn't he? Y'all, Saul was never the king he should have been because Saul never had a heart for God's people. He never had a zeal for God's name. David did. David did. Now, did David lose his way? Absolutely. Absolutely. He became a violent man with blood-stained, dirty hands. There is no covering that up. The Bible makes no attempt to cover that up. It's why God wouldn't let him build the great temple. Remember? He was a man of war. So I think it makes us ask the question, could someone with a heart like God's really be capable of sin that deep and that black? And yeah, I think they can. I think we all are. I think it's why God gave Moses that moral code for his people, to give them a framework to understand this is what's hiding inside of you. This is the ugly that lives down deep. And your brokenness shows itself in all these different ways. And I want you to understand how much that offends me. So I'm going to require an atonement be made every time you violate one of these law codes. But it will never be enough. Year after year, sacrifice after sacrifice, as hard as we try, as bad as we want it, it will never be enough. And we will never be any better. That's how deep sin runs. It's in our bones. God says you are incapable of atoning for your sin. But there is one who is able. There's one who has never been stained by sin. There's one who can and will atone for everyone's sin. And through His righteousness, His sacrifice, His perfectly complete atonement, we can be made clean. Because Jesus is enough. We're not enough. Jesus is enough. But the only way that works for us is if we acknowledge our need for His grace and we honor His sacrifice by following Him, by serving His people, and by telling His story. You see, David gave up. Okay? He gave up trying to change Saul's mind. He gave up trying to live constantly looking over his shoulder, constantly moving from place to place, hiding and hoping that Saul did not find him that day. We'll worry about tomorrow. Today, let's just stay hidden. David gave up hope that his life would ever be any better. Maybe some of y'all have been there. It happens. So David gave up, but Saul gave in. He gave in to self-promotion and he gave in to legacy building. You know, he gave in to the voices in his head and those secrets in his heart. He believed the lies that sin tries to sell. And he put himself and his interest above the people he was supposed to serve. And so God decided in his heart that David would be redeemed, David would be restored, and Saul would not. Now, we may wonder, was Saul's spirit redeemed? Only God knows the answer to that. But the lives of these two men, Saul and David, show us that even anointed kings lose their way, y'all. This happens to everybody. This comes for everyone. We fall, we compromise, just like Saul and David. And this should serve us well. These stories should serve us well. Knowing their stories should show us how much we need to lean into Jesus. Amen? We need to follow Jesus closely because this is what can happen. this is what does happen. I mean, how many stories do we have to hear about other Christian friends or pastors or church leaders or whoever falling deep into sin before we accept the fact that we are not bulletproof? We need grace. We need forgiveness. We need to pursue personal holiness. We need to follow Jesus. And we need to have tolerance for people who are just starting to figure that out. We need grace. We also need to show grace. And we need to hold each other. We need each other to hold us accountable to that. We need each other to make sure that we're doing these things. I mean, you look at Saul, you look at David. They both, at one point in their lives, they had everything. Everything. And they lost it. Now, David got it back. But Saul never did. And I don't know about you guys, but I do not want to find out which one I would be. Would I be David and get it back? Or would I be Saul and not? I don't want to be like David or Saul. I want to be like Jesus. I want to trust Jesus with everything. I want to follow Jesus wherever He wants me to go, and I don't want to have to go to Gath and make Him come get me. You know, we all have the choice. We follow Jesus or we follow somebody else. And we can intentionally decide to follow Jesus. That's what we should do. But if we don't do that, we are unintentionally allowing sin and the dark powers around us to push us towards something else. So let's reset our feet this morning, okay? Let's reset our feet to follow Jesus. Sound good? Let's do that. Let me pray for us.